From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Admit it, revenge is awesome. It can feel so good when the bad guy gets his comeuppance, and the writer Charles Duhigg says, yes, revenge is sweet, but it also happens to be an impulse that's driving our culture and our political discourse these days. Duhigg has been exploring anger, how it can be good, but also how it's getting out of hand. Today in the program, he'll join us to talk about how we need to get a grip. We'll be right back. Hey, podcast listeners, it's me again, and I just wanted to bring to your attention a new podcast that we're producing here at KUER. It's hosted and reported by the journalist Andrea Smarden, and she's been working on this for months now, trying to understand why it is we don't always get along very well. Basically, it's a podcast about finding connection, and we're going to be honest here, we're not entirely sure if we can find that connection, but each episode is going to end with this challenge where Andrea asks you to think about your own part in all of this. It's called Next Door Strangers, and you can find it wherever you get your podcasts, or you can just go online to KUER.org. Thanks a lot. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In a new article for The Atlantic, the journalist Charles Duhigg explains that America has always been an angry nation. We were born of a revolution, after all. And so the sense of anger was built into the way we designed our political system. Because anger, as he explains it, under the right conditions, is a force that helps people get things out into the open, on the table, so we can talk and work out solutions. But Duhigg is arguing that recently the tenor of our anger has shifted, for reasons we'll talk about. Whereas in the past, anger helped us release this pressure and act as a catharsis for the frustrations we were feeling, these days, Duhigg says, anger isn't relieving that pressure. It's creating different reactions, darker ones. As he puts it in the article, it's creating a desire not merely to be heard, but to hurt those who we believe have wronged us. Today in the program, we're talking with Charles Duhigg. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. His latest article is the cover story of the January-February issue of The Atlantic magazine. It's called Why Are We So Angry? The Untold Story of How We Got So Mad at One Another. He joined us from a studio in New York City, and we began our conversation with James Averill. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And as Duhigg tells it in the article, Averill is looking into anger and he starts to realize people didn't really understand it.
For many years throughout his early career, anger had been this kind of thing that if psychologists paid attention to, they kind of looked down upon.
Yeah.
Right? There's always been this myth of like the outraged working man, particularly during the Nixon years, that they were angry for Nixon, the blue collar voters. Or put differently, there was sort of this snobbery, right? That anger was this thing that we should sort of be embarrassed about.
Yeah.
It's a remnant of an outdated Neolithic. But, you know, as Averill thought about it, he thought, like, that doesn't make really any sense. Because the truth of the matter is, if there is an emotion that isn't useful, that is bad for us, is counterproductive, what tends to happen is either evolution gets rid of it or society does.
Yeah.
But anger is something that people experience all the time, right? Anger is in the Bible. It's in Shakespeare. It's in movies. I mean, if you just look at the books and media that surround you, you see anger constantly. And people feel anger, right? Yeah. I feel anger. You feel anger.
Yeah.
And Averill thought to himself, look, if this thing is so bad, it wouldn't be so common. And so he decides to institute this kind of interesting experiment.
Yeah.
Says, look, I want to find a completely normal town. And I'm going to send people surveys and say, tell me about your most recent angry experience. And like, let's get into details.
Yep.
What did you shout? Did you throw any punches? What did the other person say? How did you feel? Did you want to take revenge? So he finds this little town in Massachusetts. It has the advantage of being close to Amherst, so it's not that hard for him to get to. But it's also just a normal town. Most of the industry is a tool and die factory that's there. Churches outnumber bars. It's kind of any town in America.
Yeah.
And he sends out this survey. Now, he told me that what he expected was that people were basically going to throw the thing away. way, right? Because who's going to sit down and fill out a 14-page survey on anger? It's not only inconvenient, it's embarrassing. But instead what he finds is people return this thing like crazy.
Yeah.
It's actually one of the best performing surveys he's ever done. And in fact, people would attach thank you cards to the survey when they mailed them back in, saying, thank you so much for asking me these questions. I've been wanting to get this off my chest for so long. One respondent he told me about was this woman who I kind of fell in love with from the way he described it. She got the survey in the mail and it says, you know, describe your most recent angry episode.
Yeah.
And she knows exactly what she wants to write about.
Right.
Her husband had recently bought a brand new car, and instead of bringing that car home to show her, he took it to show his mistress first.
Right.
And she was furious, right? The wife was livid, just outraged. And so that's what she wrote about. She spent 14 pages describing how upset she was, how she had yelled at this guy when she found out that he had shown the mistress the car first.
Right. What's interesting is that Avril found that this anger, these short, angry conversations that he was hearing from this flood of replies that was coming in, led to more accommodation, more listening, and a kind of, it seems like, Charles Duhigg, it seems like a kind of relief, a release of some kind of tension.
That's exactly right. Right. So the wife who's pissed off because her husband takes the car to show the mistress, she blows up at the guy.
Yeah.
She yells at him. And he doesn't start fighting back. Instead, he says, you know, I'm really, really sorry. And they come to an agreement.
Yeah.
It's okay to have a mistress, but you got to show me the car first. The wife has to take priority. And if you think about the last time you got angry at someone, you expressed anger, something similar probably kind of happened, right? We have this myth in our head that whenever someone shouts and yells, that it exacerbates tensions, that it builds them up. But the truth of the matter is, in most cases, the majority of cases, according to studies, it actually relieves tensions because anger is the densest form of communication available to us.
Yeah.
When we shout at someone, they start listening really, really closely. And they get kind of worried, right? They start saying like, look, if you need me to change this way, I'm going to go ahead and change that way. The communication becomes very, very effective when we are angry. Anger in the lexicon of psychology is what's known as an approach behavior.
Right.
It's the opposite of antisocial. It's pro-social. It helps us live together.
You also write about how anger is a good motivator for us to try difficult things that there's some reason to believe we're more creative when we're angry. And I wondered, what's that about? Is it because anger helps us focus our sense of control or something?
I think that's part of it, right? Is that we feel like we're in control, but we also feel invigorated. We feel energetic.
Yeah.
We know that, for instance, when a leader, and this is true for men, less true for women, but when a leader says something in an angry tone, other people are more likely to think of them as competent and a good leader and decisive,
yeah.
Right? When we are angry ourselves, we tend to get this burst of energy that not only helps us accomplish things and sort of be creative, but also helps us see things in a new light. There's things that we might have overlooked, possibilities or solutions we might have ignored, that once we're angry, we're in a new frame of mind. Mm-hmm. We come back and we reconsider the options that we've previously overlooked. It feels good to be angry. It feels good to see your anger echoed by someone else. It feels motivating and energetic. And because it kind of gives us that boost of energy and it tends to change our perspective, we oftentimes see solutions that we might have missed otherwise.
So there's the good part, the part that can help, as you put it in the piece, knit society together. But a good part of the story is also the bad part, the force that can tear it apart. Let me back up, though, because it's interesting how anger, as you say in the piece, has really shaped us as a country. Even the country's mythology, you say, is rooted in anger. Explain what you mean.
Well, we are a nation, unlike many others, we are a nation that is born in revolution,
mm-hmm.
Right? We are a nation that defines ourselves in part through insurrection, a civil war. Throughout the history of this country, we have been angry, and we've oftentimes looked to that anger as a guide to how to make a better life. The American dream, when you think about it, in some ways is actually just an optimistic reframing of the anger that anyone feels about the circumstances that are handed to them in life and their deep, urgent desire to build a new life for themselves, to say no to what had been forced upon them. But even more so, if you look at the Bill of Rights, like a lot of the Bill of Rights is designed actually to preserve our anger, to give it a public sphere. The First Amendment gives us the right to shout at each other in public. Yeah. The freedom of the press means that we can disagree and attack each other in the pages of newspapers and magazines. The Seventh Amendment preserves our right to sue other people, to take our anger and our disputes to court, not to try and paper over them. And when you think about how our government works, one interesting thing and unique thing about it is by having these three branches of government, what it actually does is it encourages disputes and encourages people to only be able to make progress if they overcome their differences. But it's a system that seems committed fundamentally to exacerbating some of these tensions in the belief that doing so means that when we resolve them, we have a better world. And throughout history, we've seen that, right? Yeah. One of the things that, I mean, when we think about our proudest moments as a nation, what we tend to talk about is we talk about moments of moral outrage.
Right.
When people did the right thing because they were upset at some ethical lapse that they had to right. One of the best examples of this, I think, is the abolitionist movement from prior to the Civil War, which in a lot of ways, the same characters who started the abolitionist movement end up building the prohibition movement against alcohol, obviously a number of years later. If you look at early abolitionist texts, they're kind of divided into two categories. One of them is something that talks deeply about the ethical need to end slavery, about the injustices of this. The other is just these screeds, these angry diatribes that don't actually speak that much about the injustices against that are being perpetuated against slaves as much as the utter corruption and despicableness of the slaveholders or the slave sellers. They are furious. Yeah. And that fury, the sinners in the hands of an angry God, that fury is where the strength comes to push for a change that I think everyone in this country would agree is one of the most important moments, ethical moments in our history.
But it seems like, and this is, it's interesting, you don't actually talk about the abolitionist movement in the article, but that seems like the perfect example of these two types that leads to the third type of anger. On one hand, you have that righteous indignation, but then you have John Brown and violence, where that rage, that fury goes too far. It needs to be met. And we'll dig into this as we go. But it's funny, that abolitionist movement seems like one of the perfect examples of the point you make in the piece.
It's true. I mean, that is the thing that like is the caveat, right? Which is, if anger is so great, why isn't everyone doing it all the time?
Yeah.
It's because we know that there are real downsides to it. We know how fiery that blowtorch can be. And it's very, very easy, as basically every social movement throughout history has found, it's very, very easy to take the usefulness, the heat generated by anger, and use it for good ends. But if you're not very careful with it, then the blaze grows out of control, and it burns down everything you're hoping to accomplish.
The article makes this argument, Charles Duhigg, that the anger we're seeing today is different. This is how you put it in the piece. The tenor of our anger has shifted. Explain why this is concerning to you, why this is different from what the kind of anger we've seen in the past.
Well, I think there's a couple of things. The first is just responding to this sort of easy instinct that most people have to say, look, I'm angry right now because of Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I know in I've spent a lot of time recently in Utah, in Provo, and also, you know, wherever I travel. When people are angry, they say, look, I'm angry because of our president. And yet what we know from looking at the evidence is that that's not actually true. People aren't angry because of Trump. Trump is actually a symptom of an underlying disease, that people have actually been angry for years, that many of the same people who say they're angry about Trump, or some of them, were angry about Obama. And that anger, if you were living in a red state, about Obama was very, very vitriolic. It was a real fury. But I think that's part of it, is to sort of clarify that, look, this isn't just about one person in the White House right now. It's not going to necessarily just go away simply if that the occupant of that White House changes.
I just wanted to mention the study that you have in there from Emory University. Just 6 years ago, fewer than half of voters said they were deeply angry at the other party's presidential nominee. And now fast forward to today, that number is nearly 70%.
That's right. And that wasn't just people talking about Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton.
Right.
That was during the primaries.
Yeah.
And what's more, they didn't just say that they were angry at the other party's candidate. They said they were angry at the other party's voters.
Right.
Republicans are at record highs, think that Democrats are immoral and unethical. Democrats at record highs think that Republicans are unintelligent and are willing to trade away their ethics for some type of short-term gain. It's a very poisonous atmosphere. And this gets to the other reason of why things are different right now. It's because over about the last two decades, there has emerged a profession of what I'll call fury merchants, right? Sort of people who package rage for profit, who saw the same insights that James Averill did, right? Learned the same lessons about how anger functions and how it works, how it can be inflamed or die down. And they said to themselves, you know, there's an opportunity to make a dollar there. So one of the guys I talked to is a guy named Bob Sutton, Robert Sutton, who's at Stanford University, a wonderful, wonderful academic. He wrote a paper where he had actually reached out to a debt collection agency that was filled by the leaders of it were these really savvy guys who read all the social science research. And so they set up a training program for their debt collectors, and they let Bob Sutton come and sit along and actually make some calls, debt collection calls himself. And what they would do is they would teach their debt collectors how to inflame and then tamper down someone's anger. And it was very counterintuitive. So if you let's say they call you up and they say, hey, look, you owe us some money, and you say, hey, thanks so much. If the debtor was really friendly, the first thing that the debt collector would try to do is to try and piss them off.
Yeah.
They would say things like, look, you deadbeat. Like, if you're going to do this, then like you are the most unethical. You're a piece of slime. Like, why would you borrow this money and not pay it back? And the person at the end of the line starts getting really hot and bothered, right? They start getting angry. They're being attacked. And as soon as their anger reaches a kind of pitch, that is when the debt collector suddenly tones it down.
Yeah.
Starts saying, look, buddy, I didn't mean to get you all worked up. I'm sorry. We're both on the same side here. We want to find a solution. Let's figure out how to put this issue to bed. Like, let's figure out how to pay off this debt. And the thing that happens there is that when we do get so angry, right, two things happen. Number one, we become aroused.
Yeah.
We know that anger is an arousal. As I mentioned, it's an approach behavior. It makes us feel energetic. It makes us feel motivated. But at the same time, we also crave that cathartic release that James Averill found, right? The sense of resolution that anger usually provides.
Yeah.
And so if I'm worked up, if I'm raring to go, if you just like told me what a slime bucket I am, and then you start coming in and saying, hey, look, let me offer you that catharsis. Let's figure this problem out together. Let's be friends now. I'm so relieved that you're not yelling at me anymore. I so crave the resolution that I've come to associate with anger. Then at that point, I start agreeing with you and I start saying, yeah, no, you're right. How about I pay you 80% of what I owe?
Exactly.
Right?
It's so cynical and so minute. What did Sutton put it? He put it to you. They've basically monetized anger by making it a tool.
That's exactly right. They've monetized it. They've weaponized it. And it's not just debt collectors that do this. Once everyone started understanding how to think about these emotions as tools, then those insights spread everywhere. If you call your cable carrier today, they'll do the same thing. If you call your cell phone company and you start yelling at them, they'll do the same thing.
Wow.
These companies understand our psychology. They try and manipulate our psychology. But the biggest proponents of it, the biggest beneficiaries of it are, of course, in the current age, social media and political consultants.
Yeah.
And that's why we're so angry right now, is because we're living in a world where there are people who make money or get power by manipulating our anger. And social media, when you think about it, is a perfect example of this.
Yeah.
So what do we know about anger originally? Anger exists to help nudge us towards reconciliation. If I shout, you'll listen to me seriously enough, and it'll be so unpleasant that the two of us will probably figure out how to come to terms. But what happens when I move it onto Twitter or onto Facebook?
Yeah.
Now I shout, and the person who's listening to me, their goal, they are not sitting in a room with me. They don't have to put up with like my screams and shouts. They're halfway across the world, and we've never met before. And so what's their impulse? Their impulse is to shout back. And there's no feedback loop. There's none of the moderation that usually happens in a social situation. Now the goal is not to communicate and to resolve. Now the goal is to inflame each other. Now, Twitter doesn't necessarily want to push us to be inflamed, but they profit from it. Their algorithms recognize that the inflaming, the upset, the emotional tweets, it gets more traffic. And so the algorithms start pushing these outraged and outrageous things because they know that that's going to keep people online longer.
So
that's more money for them.
So it seems like the new part of this is, whereas in the past, anger was this one-on-one thing, or could be, this way of resolution. But now it's become distant and less connected.
That's exactly right. It's become distant and less connected. And most importantly, it's being intermediated by people who don't profit off of resolution.
Yeah.
They profit off of conflict.
Right.
Right. Nobody ever says, like, I need to go to Twitter because everyone's so friendly and passive on Twitter. No, they go to Twitter to see, well, like, what crazy new thing the president said that day. And then they put it, you know, spread it to all their friends and comment and say, this is outrageous. We all love watching people fight online. It's a natural human instinct. Conflict is entertaining.
Yeah.
And normally it just dies out on its own, unless there are companies that exist to say, my goal is to keep you online as long as humanly possible. My algorithms show me that if I have more conflict, if there are more fights going on, you're going to stick around longer. And if you stick around longer, I can put more ads in front of your eyes and I can collect more dollars. Social media's algorithms, whether by design or not, exist to exacerbate conflict because they know that that's more profitable.
Well, of course, this brings us to the role of the media and how, as you put it in the article, the cable news business has perfected the monetization of moral outrage. And one of the things you mention, and this is important, I think, to say, is that this is not just a Republican thing or a Fox News thing. Both progressives and conservatives do this. They manipulate it. MSNBC tends to be fairly good at it, you mentioned. And I have to say one of the most striking surveys in the article was one conducted in 2009 at Tufts University that you mentioned, which found, this is amazing, 100% of TV episodes and 98.8% of talk radio programs contained outrage.
That's right. That's right. And those are the opinion shows, right?
Yeah.
But you're exactly right that it's not a left or right thing. I mean, and what's interesting is that some people take real umbrage at this, right? On Twitter, I've seen that a number of people have said that they felt like comparing Fox and MSNBC is a false equivalence. And they tend to say it very angrily. But I think that's a symptom of what we're talking about here. Because actually, when studies have looked at Fox versus MSNBC, what they found is that MSNBC actually has much more commentary and opinion than Fox does. They tend to lead with it much more aggressively than Fox News. Now, they use completely different techniques, right? So on Fox, it's more kind of the angry demagoguery of the middle class or of the blue collar. On MSNBC, it's more the outrage of the elites. And so it sounds and it feels different. And obviously, when people are watching it, depending on which camp you live in, it seems very different to what you're looking at. But the playbook is the same. The playbook is get your audience riled up because they will stick around. And the best way to get them riled up is to tell them what they ought to be outraged about. And frankly, this is leadership, right? A politician's job is always to take your discontents and weave them into some story about a broader issue, a broader ethical dilemma that you're playing a role in. Our TV hosts have gotten so good at it that they do it almost unthinkingly at this point.
Yeah.
It's not because there is some, you know, benevolent political despot saying, I really want the Dems to win, or I really want the Republicans to win. They're doing it because they can sell more ads.
Charles Duhigg. He's the author of a number of books, among them The Power of Habit and Smarter, Faster, Better. His article, Why Are We So Angry?, is the cover story of the January-February issue of The Atlantic magazine. We have a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
If you're about to part ways with your old car, consider donating it to KUER. We'll take your vehicle in almost any condition, and we'll even arrange to pick it up. The proceeds from your donation support the KUER programs you love, like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Radio West. Learn more about our vehicle donation program at KUER.org.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the journalist Charles Duhigg about anger. He's written an article in The Atlantic magazine exploring anger, how it can be good, can drive change, can make people more creative and motivated. But he says anger can also be manipulated and it's getting out of hand. His article is the cover story for the January-February issue of The Atlantic magazine. It's called Why Are We So Angry? The Untold Story of How We All Got So Mad at One Another. I wanted to go back to and break down, as you do in the piece, how anger causes moral indignation that can at first be this cause for good. It's what you call this righteous rage. And a good example of it, the one that you mention, is the migrant worker protests in California in the 1960s. And it was a movement that you talk about that had stalled.
Yeah.
But Cesar Chavez is able to manage a way of harnessing this anger, and it becomes this angry, righteous movement. And this is the example of how harnessing righteous rage at first can be good. Talk about this first part, because it tends to go off the rails a bit, and Chavez has to try to bring it back. But talk about how Chavez manages to harness it, because he's pretty good at it.
No, it's a great question. So we have this good anger, right? The anger that James Averill sort of documented. But that's really a one-on-one anger. That's something that exists between people. And it's a little bit transactional. Mm-hmm. I'm angry because you brought the car to the mistress first.
Yeah.
You're going to fix it by prioritizing me. But then you get to situations like the agricultural fields of California in the 1960s. Now, the civil rights movement is going on down in the South, and it's very successful. It's starting to be successful. But in California, you have all these undocumented workers. You have a number of people who don't speak English. Terrible lives. They're exploited by the fields that they're picking fruit and vegetables in. And for years, an offshoot of the AFL-CIO had tried to organize these agricultural workers. And it was largely unsuccessful. And the reason why is because it was transactional,
yeah.
Right? The same way that like the good anger, interpersonal anger works, the owners of the fields would take advantage of that. So if my workers go on strike and I come and I say, look, I'll pay you 10 cents more an hour, but you got to go back to work right now. These are poor, desperate people. And they say, okay, 10 cents an hour, that sounds like a good deal. Mm-hmm. We go back to work. And so for years, that was the situation, is that meager, modest handouts whenever there was a labor strike in California. Mm-hmm. And then along comes this guy, Cesar Chavez, right? And Cesar Chavez is interesting. He himself is a migrant. He had moved from Arizona to California after his family had been evicted from their house. He comes from a very both a religious background, in that he had spent a lot of time around religious figures, mm-hmm. but also a very angry activist background. He had seen his parents be exposed to racism. But he says, look, if I'm going to organize the field hands of Central California, what I can't do is I can't make it about economics. Because the problem is, if it's about economics, all they have to do is throw 10 cents an hour more at us, and everyone's going to go back to work. I need to take these outrages, these economic outrages, this call for a better life, and I need to tie it into something bigger. I need to make it part of a cause. I need to convince you, field hands, that by marching, by joining me on a strike, you are actually doing what is ethically good. You are fighting for justice. And luckily for him, there's a strong tradition among this community of religious indignation, of religious justice, right? Many of the migrant workers were from Mexico, where the Virgen de Guadalupe, there's a story around that of protest and of suffering injustice and of being willing to put your life on the line in order to do what is right. And so what Chavez does is he draws on this tradition. He actually models his organization almost explicitly off of religious organizations. They have prayers. They meet in an old evangelical church. And by doing that, what he does is he ties people's economic aspirations to a movement for justice.
Right. Something larger.
No longer. Something larger than themselves.
Yeah.
No longer will 10 cents just go ahead and like resolve the strike. Now it's about justice. And the way that you do that is through moral outrage.
Right.
Right? We've seen that again and again, from abolition to what's going on right now. Moral outrage is how you radicalize people, how you convince them to believe in something bigger than themselves, and more importantly, to fight for something that is bigger than just their own self-interest. This actually started on the left.
Yeah.
The progressives, the labor unions, they've always known how to do this. It's only recently, in the last 20 or 30 years, that the right has really begun to understand and has tried to seize anger as a tool for its own.
So you have this raw element. But here comes the crucial part, at least as I saw it. You have to be able to manage it, to channel it.
Right.
So talk about this part, because you say this kind of anger can go too far. And you mentioned the time Chavez and his migrant workers movement started to lose control when others started using violence and vandalism. And Chavez basically has to go on a hunger strike to try to get things back in control.
That's exactly right. So Chavez sets up this huge march, from a 300-mile march by foot from the Central Valley of California to Sacramento to protest conditions in the agricultural fields. And it's a huge success. Bobby Kennedy flies out to celebrate it. You know, they basically get these huge concessions. Governor Brown of California is forced to meet with them. And then they go back to the fields. And the strike is still going on, right? Because only one of the big grape growers has given in. The rest of them are holding out. So they go back to the fields, and this is the hard part, right? Because they've tasted victory. They know that this works. They're still angry. They're still riled up. They're still outraged. But now they have to kind of set in for the siege, the angry siege, to get other growers to negotiate. And as this goes on, unsurprisingly, the anger builds. It becomes difficult to control. And for Cesar Chavez, this is very, very troubling, because he is someone who is committed to nonviolent protest. Right? He's grown up in the tradition of Gandhi and of Martin Luther King Jr. And he doesn't know what to do, because he has inspired this anger. He has fed this anger. But now this anger is growing out of control, as anger always does. It's getting bigger and bigger. And in fact, the only way that he thinks that he can stop it is to announce that he is going to go on a fast. He's going to stop eating to inspire his followers to recommit to nonviolent protest. So he starts the fast. He goes into this small adobe building that used to be a gas station, and he begins fasting. He drinks water but consumes no food. And a week goes by, and people say, like, okay, look, you've sort of made your point. Like, this is fine.
Yeah.
And then another week goes by, and he's a small man to begin with, and he's slight. And as the days go by, he is getting weaker and weaker. He is losing weight. He's visibly deteriorating. And he's saying the entire time, listen, the only way that we can win, the only way that we can do right by this moral justice that we are trying to create, is if we promise to be better than our enemies, if we promise to be nonviolent, if we promise to be more moral. And the only way that I can convince you of that, it seems, the only way I can wake you up, it's not to shout anymore, it's not to be angry, it's to flirt with death, to starve myself. Almost an entire month goes by without him eating. He's so frail that he actually can't walk, he can't speak. Local newscasts are doing news reports speculating that he might die. Thousands of people come to watch him, to be with him in this small adobe building. And eventually he emerges and he consents to begin eating again. But as one person I talked to put it, this anger, the motivating force of this moral outrage, it is so powerful and so dangerous if it gets out of control.
Yeah.
That the only way to control it sometimes is for a leader to threaten their own life, to try and cool passions and tempers.
Wow.
That's how powerful it is.
It's almost like you have this moral indignation that's good at first. It's an impulse for such amazing things. But then it's like it has this expiration date. Like when this moral indignation persists too long, it's like it goes off and it can produce, as you explain in the article, another type of anger. And this is that desire for revenge. Let's talk about that, this revenge impulse, as it's called.
Well, you're right. And I think the turn there is that moral outrage can be a double-edged sword, right? The thing that it provides for us is sustained energy and motivation.
Yeah.
But that also means it provides sustained energy and motivation, which means that you're still angry months after you first started fighting.
And what am I supposed to do with all of this anger?
What am I supposed to do with all this passion, all this upset, this thing that's keeping me up at night? Now, as long as people believe that change is possible, as long as they believe that it might take some time, but eventually the system is going to work, they are going to recognize and listen to my anger, we will come out and justice will prevail. As long as that belief exists, then moral outrage needs to be controlled, it needs to be managed, but it won't become toxic.
Yeah.
But then at some point, very often what happens is some people become disillusioned. They start to believe in what's known as procedural justice has broken down.
Mm-hmm.
And we see this all around us now, right? They start to believe that no matter how much they scream and shout, this unethical situation, this moral outrage, it will not change. The system is corrupt. People are preventing them from making progress. And when that happens, there's a switch that flips in our brain. And we go from being angry and outraged to wanting revenge.
Yeah.
And this is very dangerous because when you want revenge, and we know this from psychological studies, you actually have very different goals. So when I'm angry, whether it's moral outrage or just the good anger, my goal is to change things and sort of resolve my anger. When I want revenge, my goal is to hurt the other person. In fact, studies show that I won't stop wanting revenge until not only do I hurt the other person, but that person admits that they were wrong, which almost never happens, right? Even when you defeat your conquer your foes, they very infrequently say, you know what? You were right and I was wrong. And so as a result, this need for revenge, it becomes a hole that can never be filled. It's poisonous. It's corrosive. And what's really interesting, you know, in the story we talk about the teacher strikes in Oklahoma.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
One person in particular, this guy named Larry Cagle, who kind of found his life overcome with this deep anger and desire for revenge. He became, I think in some respects, the kind of person that not only did he not want to become, but that he hated. He went out of his way to try and disrupt his own school. He wanted to throw things into chaos. He was so focused on trying to punish the people who had cut funding to education, who had made his life so hard, who were hurting students, that all he could think about was hurting them. And he fell into this trap of rumination, right? We've all felt this, this situation where you're so angry, you just can't stop thinking about it all the time. You want to stop thinking about it. You're desperate to stop thinking about it. And yet your mind unbidden returns again and again to the thing that makes you angry, to how much you want to punish those people. It's really hard and it's really dangerous and it's just really heavy. It's a terrible thing, burden to carry.
Well, Cagle talks about how, I mean, it starts to hurt his family, but he says he just couldn't stop. I think what's interesting though is He didn't, when he was talking to you, he didn't see it as revenge, even though it clearly seems to be. He told you this. He said, sometimes you have to burn something down to save it, which sounds noble, but also really scary.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the thing about revenge is that oftentimes we don't know that we're in the revenge mindset when we are in the revenge mindset. That's why it's so dangerous. And so And yet we also know that the environment that makes that mindset more likely is the environment where people, as I mentioned, believe that systems have stopped working, which brings us to today, right? Let's look at what's happened in the last 10 years because we're on the anniversary of the Bernie Madoff scandal and, and just a little bit over the 10-year anniversary of Bear Stearns. So in the last 10 years, we have seen our entire financial system melt down and really almost no one from Wall Street go to jail for that. We have seen the big banks get bailed out and a number of homeowners lose their homes. We have seen an election where one person won the popular vote and the other person was put into the presidency. Yeah. You don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to begin believing that our systems aren't working like we want them to, like they're supposed to, like we have faith in them. That is so dispiriting that you can't blame people who say, look, I don't think the system is working anymore. Now, I don't agree with them. I think the system is working and can work, but I understand and sympathize with that mindset. And when you're angry and you believe that your anger is not going to accomplish anything because the system is corrupt or the system is broken or procedural justice is broken down, that is when you start thinking to yourself, all I want to do is beat the other guy.
Yeah.
All I want to do is let my party win, and when we're in office, we're just going to stick it to the other side. That's when you get revenge mindset, and it just leads us on a path to disaster again and again and again.
You come around in the piece to this question of what we do about this sense of wanting revenge, which you describe and even confess is delicious. You know, it's tempting.
Oh, absolutely.
And Schadenfreude is great. But then you say, all right, but what do we do with it? Where do we go from here? And this gets us to an experiment conducted by some social scientists in Israel.
Right.
I wanted you to talk about this because I think this is really instructive.
You know, in many ways, Israel has been dealing with these issues on a more profound level for many more years than we have. Obviously, because of the question, the Palestinian question, they are surrounded by people who wish to do harm to Israel, and Israel itself has done harm to its neighbors, and so these questions of vengeance and of anger are something that in many ways are more. It's a more sophisticated and more evolved conversation in Israel, simply because it's been going on for longer, and the stakes in some ways are higher. And so this group of researchers come together and they start trying to figure out, okay, look, what can we do to try and lower the temperature? Yeah. Because for years there's been this theory called the contact hypothesis, which says, okay, look, this is how you reduce prejudices. You get people to stop being angry with each other. If you can just find people and put them in the same room together and like make sure that they have like, you know, take away all the provocation, bring up some topics that they can both talk about. Then once they see each other as people, once they learn to kind of like learn that they have similar goals and similar problems, then the prejudices will fade. It'll be easier for people to get along, right? This is what we tell our kids.
Yeah.
It's really easy to demonize that person. Just go walk a mile in their shoes and you're going to sympathize with them more. That's a great theory. It turns out it does not work a lot of the time. And it particularly does not work in a place like Israel, right? Mm-hmm. People who came up with that theory clearly never visited Tel Aviv.
Yeah.
Because in Tel Aviv, Palestinians and Israelis, they have lived alongside each other for centuries. And that does not seem to have tampered down the anger or the passion. So what this group decides is like, look, not only that, but they know that the neighborhoods that they're working in, the neighborhoods that they're working in, they do not want to spend more time with Palestinians.
Yep.
It's a conservative neighborhood. They're on the religious right. They vote for these these anti-Palestinian candidates in all the elections. So what the researchers say is, look, we're going to go into this neighborhood, and instead of telling people you should be more calm and accepting, you should welcome your neighbors, we're going to tell them, you know what? You're right. The Palestinians, they're terrible. In fact, this war, what's referred to as the conflict within Israeli society, the conflict, it's a great thing because the truth of the matter is, and this is, they put up advertisements all over town saying this, they hand out balloons. They say, the truth of the matter is everything we love about our country, we actually get from the conflict, right? How would we have heroes if we didn't have a conflict to make those heroes? How would we be so moral if we didn't have a conflict to prove to us that we are willing to tolerate such injustices without striking back? They start running these crazy advertisements, these bombastic advertisements that agree with the prejudices to this extreme that is irrational, ridiculous. And what's amazing, the people in this town that they're running the ads in, they love them. They don't see them as satire. They think they make a lot of sense. In fact, they say like, you're right. We should continue this war. Without war, how would we know who is the bravest among us? But then they up the ante. They start making these ads that are more and more bombastic, more and more ridiculous. And at some point, people start saying, you know what? Like, I was with you for a little while there, right, but this is a little bit too much. Like, I don't actually think we should go bomb Palestinians just to prove to ourselves that we are more moral than they are, right? I don't think we need to engage in battles to figure out who are the heroes. But that doesn't matter. The ads keep on going, more and more bombastic. And then they stop. And they go, and these researchers, they survey the crowd. And what they find is that the crowd suddenly is more tolerant. They're less hateful. They're less angry. Some of them even support things that are considered radical, like freezing the building of settlements in the occupied territories. And they're trying to figure out why. And one of them actually said this thing to me that helped explain it. He said, look, you know when you go to a baseball game and you're sitting in the stands and you shout something at the other team, right? You shout like, you know, you bums, you guys deserve to lose. And then the guy sitting next to you who've never met before, he says the same thing, and then he starts shouting these racist things at the other team, right? He goes way overboard. He's so extremist. And suddenly you feel embarrassed because he's reminding you, you're acting like a little bit of an extremist, maybe not as much of an extremist as him, but we shouldn't be shouting at the other players or calling them bums. That's not polite. Sometimes you need something to reflect back to you, to let you know when you have become an extremist. And I think that's what's happening in America right now. We don't need social scientists to run crazy advertisements that are over the top. We literally have a president who's doing it for us. Or we have friends on Facebook. Or we have Fox News or MSNBC. All you have to do is turn on your computer and you can find people whom you like and admire and respect saying hyperbolic things, indulging their anger, acting like an extremist. We need to look at that mirror and realize the extremist has become us. And the only way it changes is for us to decide to become less angry, which is hard.
Yep.
It takes sacrifice. But it's the only way forward.
We need our anger, you say. We need our moral outrage. But we just can't continue at this pace. So explain the lesson you mentioned in the life of W.E.B. Du Bois. Dr. King pointed out Du Bois had been angry all of his life and had good reason to be, but that somehow he managed to find a way to overcome that and to find some kind of peace. Say something about that. How did he manage to do that?
I think the same way that everyone throughout history who has taken this so seriously that they know that they can't indulge their lower instincts, their base pleasures, has done it. If you're someone like W.E.B. Du Bois or Martin Luther King, and if you've spent your entire life fighting to make things better, you must be furious, right? Think about, let's take Martin Luther King because he's better known. A man who spent his entire life being being oppressed because of his leadership. Someone who came from a family where they had experienced racism, had grown up in the South where Jim Crow was a part of life. How could you not be furious? How could you not feel that moral indignation and that just fury every single day? And yet at some point he knew very early in his life as a young man, he was in his 20s when the Montgomery bus boycott occurs, that the answer is not to just be angry. It's at some point to use that anger to turn the other cheek, to say, look, I believe in a higher goal. I am willing to swallow my anger if that means that the world is going to become better. And that swallowing, that is hard. Today, what that means is that means that when you go on Facebook or you go on Twitter and someone posts something about how the president is an idiot and look at this mistake he made, or the Democrats are an idiot and look at these mistakes Nancy Pelosi made. It means that instead of reading that and then just savoring that sense of like that schadenfreude, that sense of righteousness, that you have to swallow it and you have to say, look, I will not support this kind of anger. Even if I like it, even if I think it's right, I do not want to live in an angry world. I am going to turn the other cheek and I am going to try to make the world a better place. When you look at the biblical passages about turning the other cheek, what's interesting about them is it does not say that you get any grace from doing so. It does not say that it doesn't hurt or that it will make things better right away. What it says is that over time, hopefully it means your children won't get slapped at all. That is what we have to believe in deeply enough to swallow our anger, to swallow that gleeful, pleasurable instinct for revenge, and to say, I want to genuinely make the world better by finding someone on the other side of this aisle that I can agree with and by supporting them. And I'll tell you what this means for me. It means for me that, for instance, for one thing, I don't read those tweets. I block those people on Twitter. I block those people on Facebook. But even more importantly, I actually have a pledge to not only find candidates in both parties I can vote for to split my ticket, but to give money to people on the other side. Right? I'm a registered Democrat, and most of the people that I would normally support are Democrats. But in this last election cycle, I went and I found three Republicans that I gave money to, money that I would have otherwise given to Democrats, because I believe you have to become the moderation and tolerance that you want to see in the world. And it's not enough just to say, it's not enough to say there should be a return to civility when what you really mean is the other side should be more civil.
Yeah.
What you have to do is you have to sometimes even swallow your principles a little bit, support someone who you don't agree with 100% if it means that we can find a way to populate our government and our leadership and our culture and our society with people who are committed to finding resolution, to using anger to the good ends, rather than just giving in to that schadenfreude desire to watch it all burn down.
Charles Duhigg, his latest article is the cover story for the newest issue of The Atlantic magazine. It's called Why Are We So Angry? The Untold Story of How We All Got So Mad at One Another. He joined us from a studio in New York City. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.